Hey everybody, this is Richard Sanchez and I'm here with Steve Jacks of the Render Bar. You know, we're trying something new with season two where we're recording al fresco outdoors in beautiful Alhambra, California, and it's been a year. You know, the state of the industry right now, we just came out of a long strike and then our contracts were ratified, first SAG-AFTRA, then the WGA, and we thought we'd go back to work, and we didn't. And a lot of people said, well, once the Teamsters and IATSE sign a contract, we'll go back to work. And we signed a contract, and we didn't go back to work. And that was riding out the remainder of the year. I know the standard refrain you heard was survive till 25, and here we are in 25. I don't know. What's your experience been like, Steve?
I don't know, man. It's interesting because I hear that I've been lucky enough to be working since fall of 23, right after the strikes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel I'm in my little bubble of work, but I know like I had a meetup with some of my old coworkers a couple weeks ago, and I had a chance to kind of register. Yeah, there's a lot of folks still not working, you know, like old coworkers from past seasons of shows I've worked on, and to notice that, like, yeah, some folks aren't working right now, and that's kind of the standard, you know. Some folks haven't been, like, I worked on Skeleton Crew, and some
great
folks,
show, by the way.
Thanks. Some people haven't been working since then, when we wrapped last summer. So, you know, it is the way things are, and it's rough. I don't know what else to say about it, you know. So it's, I don't know where other people stand right now. With, are they still holding out for work, or are they trying to, you know, think of other, you know, alternative means of income, or are people leaving LA?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly heard of people speaking of either trying to find a temporary new job, some people just leaving altogether, and kind of to your point about kind of being in a bubble, it's, you know, anyone who's been in the business for a while knows that, you know, the nature of a freelance world is that the best people tend to always work, and that's why they're the best. And then people in the middle, we have feast and famine, and, you know, that just kind of comes with the territory. You mm-hmm. take a month or so off, and then people who maybe have a less than stellar reputation struggle, and that's the nature of freelance. But what I think is striking about this is, and I'm sure you've seen this too, I've certainly seen it, when I get people calling me up and they go, hey, have you heard of anything? And I'm like, you are the 1%. How are you not working?
Oh, yeah,
and it's affecting everybody.
Yeah, for sure. In my bubble, because I've been working with Lucasfilm, mm-hmm. For so long, it's kind of rolling from one show to another. And since being out here, I've worked with that crew of people. So my bubble is the crew of people that I've been working with for so long, versus jumping around from show to show with working with a new group each time. And I'm so grateful for the shows I've been working on and for being employed, steadily employed, which has been wonderful. But I can only imagine whenever work isn't coming, and what do? Reminds me of, like, back when I was younger, when, you know, people didn't know me enough, and I had to struggle between jobs and find something else in the meantime to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how difficult it is as an adult, families making mortgage payments and keeping your head afloat.
Yeah, and there was a time when you could negotiate higher rates, you could command a higher rate, and you could, for lack of a better term, kind of be a little cocky in terms of negotiation, you know, just like the whole idea of someone comes to you and they say, I'm going to pay you this, and you say, I'm not taking that. You got to pay me more. And unfortunately, it feels like we're not really there right now. I know that's something I feel like I say that in caution, because the more people who hear me say this, you know, might take advantage of that. Oh, we got them where we want them and can depress rates. But there is something to be said of, you know, my last job, I was working for about $1,000 per week less than I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those things, is the alternative is you just don't work. And so there's something to be said about holding the line and keeping our rates high, because any opportunity for those to be depressed will be taken advantage of. But at the same time, when there isn't work, there isn't work. And I'm always trying to encourage our colleagues to hold out, and you should be paid what you're worth. But I can't fault people who I have a, they have families, they have a mortgage.
You gotta take the job.
That's it.
Yeah. Now the job you're on now, are you classified as VFX editor in the new contract?
I'm not.
Or?
I'm working on this show. I'm working as an assistant editor. So for those who don't know, part of the new contract is we actually got the classification of VFX editor in the Editors Guild contract. For the longest time, that was not actually a designation. And for those who don't know, VFX editors, if you work for a vendor, if you're working at, say, ILM or Weta or Digital Domain, you're probably non-union. You're working vendor side. But if you're working production side, meaning you're working with the show editor and the director, you're probably union. And for the longest time, depending on what show you were on, you were either classified as an assistant editor or as an editor, and there was distinct advantages to one over the other, and now we officially have a designation, which is a cool thing. But no, to answer your question succinctly, no, I'm not working as a VFX editor.
Okay.
But there's something to be said about VFX editing is critical to any film. And,
yeah.
And
I think it's great, though, because, you know, the assistant editors that were doing a lot of being forced to do a lot of visual effects editing work, tracking, even if it wasn't like temp comps as much as it was just tracking VFX shots, how cumbersome that can become.
Incredible.
And that's not your bread and butter, and then you're not getting paid for it. You know, I have that experience of, you know, the best I got once was getting credited for both jobs. But, you know, getting a pay bump because of it would be even better.
Yeah.
You know, that's great that that's what's happening right now.
Yeah.
I know a friend who I think was assisting, and or no, maybe he was he was assisting, and then he did end up doing enough VFX work that they bumped him up. He had to be bumped up to VFX editor, and that was great for him. Just in that we need to be compensated for the work that we do. That's how productions get the best of us, by when we say yes to doing more work for less money.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said earlier, right now it's tough because you just got to take the job. That's one, that's kind of an aside from the day to day.
Sure.
I'm doing job A, but they want me to do job A and B, but they're only paying me for job A.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, on iTanya, I did that. I was hired as an assistant editor and I had to fight for my rate because they wanted to, you know, lowball me.
Yeah.
Even as an assistant editor.
And you were doing face replacements on Margot Robbie.
I wasn't doing it, but yeah,
you
mean,
were preparing.
We had VFX. Our vendor 8 effects were doing face replacement, crowd tiling, and you know that's all they budgeted for. And then we had a lot of other shots too. You know that just happen, as you know, when you're editing. Like, let's make this a split screen. Let's paint out that boom mic. You know, there's all these extra shots that come into play.
Yeah.
And what started as a certain number of shots became a lot larger. And that became more for me as the only assistant editor.
Yeah.
To have to do, you know, keep up with, you know, doing sound design work for my editor.
Sure.
And those assistant editor tasks, to also tracking all the VFX shots, preparing sequences for our vendor.
Mm-hmm.
And just managing all of that in a database and keeping up with it.
Yeah.
It was really hard because it's double duty, you know? And at the time I didn't know enough to say, well, I knew enough to say we needed a VFX editor.
Yeah.
But I didn't know enough to say how much it would take away from my duties as an assistant editor.
Sure.
I knew that it required another body, but I didn't have the education to tell my post-soup this is what we needed, but my post-soup didn't really have that information either.
Yeah.
And that's not a knock on anyone, just the nature of, we all have our experience and we know what we're doing to a degree, but if we haven't experienced a new set of hurdles, then we don't really know how to maybe handle it. So,
well, I think there's something to be said too about, you know, on a film like that, you know, you're working on a film with less resources. You're not working on a Marvel film with four assistant editors
and
whatnot.
Yeah,
so.
And on that, like, you expect.
Yeah.
Like, we know, oh, it's a big movie. We expect to need three or four VFX editors.
Yeah.
And on a small movie, you're like, oh, we don't. But times change. That's part of it. Times change. And on a small film like that, that's a couple million dollars. We probably don't need any visual effects. But now, it's standard. So, I mean, that was, what? We shot that 2017, 16?
Mm-hmm.
I was in post on that in 2017. So, I don't know what small films are like now in terms of if any of you are working on small independent films, I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, is this becoming standard hiring a VFX editor on a small indie film? Or is the assistant editor still doing all that work? Which I imagine is probably still the case. You probably want an assistant editor because of the budgets. But I'm glad that there's now that designation that folks can kind of hopefully get a little bump up for doing that work.
Yeah. And also the hiring parties acknowledge the speciality that comes with the job, because I do think some people sort of associate the VFX editor position as a glorified assistant editor job. And there are similarities to the assistant editor job, but the specificity and the level of detail required for VFX turnovers are just so high. And I find for someone who hasn't done it, sometimes it's easy to shrug it off as turnover is a turnover, and that is just so not true. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, as an assistant editor, I found, and especially starting in reality TV, where we would basically just turn over an AAF and call it a day, and they would work with that, which is not to diminish the work that assistant editors in reality TV do. Reality TV is so hard, and I have endless respect for that work. But I found that, like, when I would work on these films, and, like, a film that is organized is easy to turn over. If your timeline is clean on all the tracks, the track organization is good. I mean, yeah, you need 6 reels turned over. I can get that for you in an hour and a half. But if you have to clean it up, it's a lot to work. And same thing with visual effects when you're talking about, you know, checking for shot length changes. I mean, that's one of those things where that could take you, you know, half a day. That could take, I still remember we had a particularly difficult episode on Ahsoka, and I remember tracking changes on that episode took me 2 days.
Really?
Yeah, I remember I basically had to kick my editor out of the episode and just say, I need this episode for 2 days. I can't have you coming in. And of course, that's not really a request I can make.
Right.
It just is what it is. But what it just meant, it was just such a complex episode that I'm just like, let me find it, get all our ducks in a row. And I still remember handing these reports to our PM, and it was absurd. Just like, yeah, this was a rough one.
All the little bits of changes everywhere.
Yeah.
And then determining which ones are worth sending and which ones aren't. You know, yes. Small changes, don't bother. But that's still work you have to do. You have to still track every single change to know which changes are important.
Yeah.
And which ones aren't. And that's it can be exhausting.
And you know, it's funny, the psychology of what you do alert people to and what you don't. Because I always feel as a VFX editor, it's imperative that I know everything at all times in my cut, which is probably why I have so much anxiety, because I hold myself up to that standard. Mm. Not that I always actually do hold to that, but I think that that's kind of my goal. And I always want to be aware of everything that changes. But like you say, if I tell every vendor every time when one frame changes, when two frames change, you're going to drive them nuts. And at the same time, it's kind of one of those things, too. You also get a feel for your editor and your director. Like, I think that shot's going to come back. Yeah, they trimmed it by 10 frames. I think that's coming back. I don't think I'm going to tell the vendor yet. Because if I tell the vendor that, they're going to cut it down. And then if those 10 frames come back, it could turn into a big deal. So it's like,
And sometimes that stuff that you should talk to your visual effects producer about, and what their game plan is for that, if you have one. And maybe it's a smaller film, and it's really just you talking to the vendor.
Yeah,
you know, I've had that experience, and then maybe you're sending every single change, and they're gonna trim it. Oh, well, they said it's shorter. They trim it because they want to save money.
Yeah.
But then you shoot yourself in the leg because you're going to have to need those frames later in the end when they expand that shot. So for those who are new to it, the best thing to do is to talk to your VFX producer or your VFX PM and just discuss with them, like, what's the best way to handle this? Do you want to, we go to the standard of like, if it's like under 20 frames, don't worry about it. Don't even bother sending it. Because that's that wiggle room that you can go back and forth with in the edit. But anything more than that, then maybe it's worth trimming it back. But it's not something that you necessarily as a VFX editor make that call on your own.
Yeah.
You know, if you're starting out as a VFX editor, not everything lies at your feet. You have other people to talk to about. Talk to your editor. Hey, what do you think? How much leeway do you think? Some editors are different. Some editors know exactly what they're cutting, and this is it. I've made my choices, and I know what I want.
And I'm not.
And other editors really let their cut be a lot more fluid, mm-hmm. and they're really finicky with the framing. They're making little changes everywhere. So then maybe they want to have more of those handles in case they want it.
Well, and likewise with your vendors, oftentimes vendors want those shots trimmed down because they're trying to save however many frames they want to render. Every vendor, they bid the show and they say, we're going to do X amount of shots, but it always seems like, sure, they actually bid 1,000 frames, but they're kind of hoping that they can whittle it down to 800 by the end. And it's one of those things where I can empathize with that because everybody wants to save resources and money. But at the same time, from my standpoint, I'm always thinking, well, you agreed to this and I kind of need that flexibility. But I do find sometimes when you're in a situation where somebody is insisting, I need you to trim those down. I'll try to then reframe it in terms of, I'm happy to trim this for you and I'll give you new count sheets like you ask. Mm-hmm. And I will let you know every time a single frame changes. But if the edit changes and those frames come back, I don't want you to be upset and I don't want you to give me resistance, you know?
Yeah.
Now, as much as you can lay that out as a disclaimer, you might still get, protest. But I think if at least you've done that, you've been straight up and honest. Because there is a certain amount of embellishment both with, we can get that done. We can get that done. And can you really? Can you really? And I'm always of the opinion, under promise, over deliver. You know, I'd like to believe in a world where I'll just say, I'm going to tell you exactly what I'm capable of. I'll tell you where I'm weak. I'll tell you where I'm strong. And I'll tell you what I can realistically deliver. And if you can build a realistic expectation based upon what I'm telling you, you can take my words at face value and know that I'm being honest with you. The problem is, oh, get that thing done in 2 hours. Yeah. You mean the thing that takes 8 hours?
Yeah.
That we've talked about that takes that long?
Yeah. That's where you need to understand. That reminds me of times when I had to learn how to say, well, wait, when do you need this done by?
Yeah.
Before I say yes, it's like, I say, yep, I'll do it. But like, when do you need it by?
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure if you're asking that you want it done now, or if you want it done by end of day, or if you want it done by tomorrow or next week.
Yeah.
And then that determines how much priority I should put on that task.
Sure.
On knowing how long it might take.
Yeah.
You were talking about count sheets before. I want to know what's new in your database these days. Like, what's kind of some new things you've added to your VFX database that you're into, if anything? I'm always adding a little, like, you know, something comes up that I didn't really need before. Now I needed it.
Yeah.
New script, new code, and some new calculation that's helped me out with something. Anything?
You know, actually, the biggest thing is I've been focusing more on keeping my database as minimalist as possible. Actually, one of the biggest things I've been doing with my database, just to make it a little cleaner and sleeker, is I used to have buttons, and the buttons all had text on them, so that the button would say tools, it would say import, and actually what I found is FileMaker has these icons, these pre-built icons, and you can even make custom icons. And what's nice about that is, like, you know, I'll make an icon of like a little wrench, and the wrench is for tools.
Yeah.
And like, if I want a button that like it copies a piece of text from one field to another, I'll just get a little icon that looks like an arrow. And I find actually it's kind of one of those things is aesthetics, but
it's like the UI experience, right? UX, is that what they call it? User experience, like trying to that does sound very much like trying to minimalistic in a way.
Yeah.
To keep it just as simple as possible.
The other thing that I haven't played with that much, and I've been doing it a lot lately, is tooltips. So instead of having to waste all of this extraneous space on my database with a button that is text so that the user can read it, is there's an icon. Maybe that icon, though, isn't super intuitive as to what it means. So there's a little section in FileMaker that lets you put a little tooltip. So you just hover your mouse over it, and it'll say, this button means this.
Oh.
And then that way.
So rather than clicking a button, you hover over a little section, a little icon, and then it just pops up.
Yeah, that way you benefit from the sleekness of an icon, but if you want the detail of a description, it just comes out.
That's pretty cool. Something I just did right now, because I'm using your EDL importer tool. I think you call it something else, maybe.
No, I call it the
EDL importer, yeah.
For those who don't know, the EDL importer is a product that we sell at mastertheworkflow.com, but it actually originated on Ahsoka when Steve and I were working together, and that it's just kind of, I've built it out into a generic tool, just a bunch of metadata tools for VFX editors.
Yeah, I loved it because it's like a lot of these things you need to import to check changes, but you don't need to store it in your database.
Mm-hmm.
So what's cool is that it's our own little separate database
file.
It's a utility file tool. And what I recently did was I have my main VFX database that I'm using all the time, but then I'll pop open the EDL importer tool when I need it. But what I realized is that I could create a button in my database that says, open the EDL importer tool file itself. So now I can, and it's just something I never thought I would need to do, but there's a way to set a button and then say open file, and I navigate to that file on my desktop, and it will just open it right up exactly without any lag time or anything. Just open that file, and then I have another button that says close that file. There might be a better way to do it, but I have like a button that says open and close.
Yeah.
And now I can just easily hop into that tool and then close it without having to navigate in my Finder to the EDL importer every single time. And so that's been helpful to save time on like, oh, I need to do some changes. Boom, open it up or add markers or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's something I've been doing lately. Not really to check changes right now, but we had to go through and do some like locator updating stuff at the moment. But
yeah,
I use that a lot, and that's been such a huge help. I know a lot of other people have their own methods of checking changes. Yeah. I highly recommend this tool. It's the fastest way that I've been able to get through that crazy bit of what can feel like it takes days to get a day to get through changes in an episode.
The pain train.
We're real. Yeah, we used to call it the pain train. When I was on Deepwater Horizon, a VFX editor I worked with called it the pain train because it was a pain in the ass to go through the entire cut shot by shot by shot by shot because it was such a manual labor. To go through. And now we kind of can not have to call it the pain train anymore because it's a lot more automation. You know, in a way, that's where automation's good.
Yeah.
To help you do things. It's not so automatic that it's doing all the work by itself. You have to prep it, but it's still a lot faster.
Yeah.
And a lot faster than going shot by shot, that's for sure.
Yeah. The tried and true method is you gang two sequences and you just drive through them, and that works, but it's so easy. I don't know if you remember the film The Andromeda Strain from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I remember they were looking for a cure for the disease, and there's a scene where the woman is so exhausted and her eyes are glazed over, and at one point there's a shot where the computer finds the cure for the disease, and she's so tired that she skips past it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is often me doing
I've done that. So I used to do that same thing. You have your benchmark reel, and you gang it to the new reel, and you just go shot by shot by shot by shot, checking your markers, checking your cuts.
Yeah.
And everything gangs together, and everything's fine. Great. Move on.
Yeah.
But the problem is, if you missed a change three cuts ago, you're going to miss it every cut going forward to the end of time. And that's where the EDL importer tool is great because you're checking it not from one cut to another, you're checking against the database.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that wasn't something I ever had done before. It was mostly checking, assuming that I've updated the database, that the last cut I did is correct.
Yeah.
The EDL tool says, well, I'm going to base it off of what you've entered into the database.
Yeah.
Against what the current cut is. And that's where you catch the changes. That's where you catch, oh, well, you wrote that it was 20 frames, but now it's 30. Or whatever, you know, or even worse, it was 100 frames, now it's only 10 because they chopped a lot off.
Yeah.
Or an extension, you know. Yeah. And that's been great to catch those things.
Yeah.
Satisfying.
Yeah.
In a way. But it's nuts whenever, like you said, you have like, they restructure a scene or sequence, cutting things all around, new shots, old shots. Old shots are back. New shots are in. So you have to find what's new, what's old. Oh, it's a new take. Oh, is it the same? Is it the same shot or a different shot?
Yeah.
Is it a new take or does it look, All these little things you have to catch, and it's...
The take swaps are so deceptive, especially when it's a performance that's really subtle, and it'll be like, oh, the director liked that thing in the background, and you're like, oh, okay, I see it now, but gosh, that was so subtle.
Well, worse is whenever the shot subcap titles at top aren't also lifted when they change the cut.
Yeah.
And so now you got to really do a lot of detective work to find out what's different.
Well, you know, and actually you bring up a good point too, because I still remember before I worked on shows that had really complex animation, my rationale was always, if the plate changes, it's a new shot.
Yeah.
And I've actually come around to the idea that that's not always true, actually, in a show that has complex animation. Basically, Marvel and Lucas, you know, if you have like a CG robot or a CG character, the idea of, well, the animation team is doing all this work and they swapped out the plate and the plate itself is changing, but the animation isn't changing. And so you keep the same shot number and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it's, I think it's more of a accounting thing, because when people see a number go away and a new one come in, there's costs associated with that. And I was like, okay, I'm coming around to that. Yes, okay. I used to get really frustrated when people would say it's a plate swap, but I'd say it's not a plate swap, that's a new shot. And it's like, okay, no, I need to come back off my damn high horse.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, it's if the take changes, it's a new shot.
Yeah,
because I know from doing more temp comp work on the project I'm on now that if the plate changes, I gotta start a new project.
Yeah. So you're within a fortunate bubble. You're working. I am also within a fortunate bubble. I am also working. But you know, actually, one thing I kind of wanted to touch upon too, and I wonder how much of this has affected other people, is I had a job coming out of the strikes that started pretty early. I was actually in a extraordinarily fortunate position, and due to a variety of factors, I actually had a pretty significant panic attack, and a part of it was probably being out of work for a while. Like, at a certain point, it becomes foreign to you.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it just kind of wasn't for me at that moment. And
you've told me this story before, so I know that there's a lot of details and factors that go into that. It doesn't just come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's not even just being in over your head and like you're not qualified to do a job. I know that's not what that was. But the idea that you are put into a position, the schedules are such that you're already, day one you show up and you're already behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that can only affect, you can only get through that so much mentally before you like, I know I had that when I was on, was it on Happy? Maybe the first season of Happy, when I was really getting into VFX editing, where I only knew my one way to do pulls, and it was very labor intensive and very manually oriented. And that I'd be like going insane in my brain because I got to stay super late to get this entire sequence out, or whole episode or something. Might have been an entire episode that we were like turning over episode by episode or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I'm like going nuts. I'm like, just like my brain is hurting and staying late. And I'm the last one there. And you can only take that so much before, and knowing if you have to dread that walking in the next day.
Yeah.
That you know it's just not any better.
Yeah.
And maybe it's from management, from the top, how they're running things, that there's only so much you can do as a VFX editor to try to steer the ship a certain way. But if everybody around you is like running with their, you know, like they're all caught on fire.
Yeah.
Then there's only so much you can do. And I certainly can lead to like a panic attack where you like don't know what to do.
Yeah.
That must have been awful to have to go through that.
Well, you know, it was awful for a variety of reasons. One, I felt a great degree of shame. The people I was working with, I have the utmost respect for them. It was just, I felt like I let them down. And also, just at a time when so many people weren't working, I was like, Richard, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Are you insane? No, you figure a way to make that work, because nobody's working. This is the most illogical thing you've ever done. And I feel fortunate that in talking to them, because I've talked to most of them since then, I don't feel that they've judged me and that they've made me feel bad. And I recognize that that is fortunate, because not everyone is cool like that. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, even if they weren't, I had to do what was right for me. But I feel very fortunate that they were good people. And I think there's something to be said of, we're all going to hit a point when burnout is going to become a real factor in our lives. It's a demanding job. And I think I would say every one of us either has faced it, is currently facing it, or will face it.
Yeah.
You know, until there's a major change to the work culture in our field, everybody has faced it, is facing it, or will face it. And I think there's something to be said about knowing when you can just say, I need to take care of me.
Yeah. And the times are changing as well. So I know that while the industry still isn't like the best place for self-care and being open about, it's all about the job. It's about the project. Got to get the project done. That's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Who cares about your feelings or your health?
Or your family.
Or your family or anything. But I can say that in my career, I have noticed the change.
Yeah.
You know, and granted, it all depends who you work with.
So very much so.
You know, and I've worked a lot of the same people for the past few years. So I'm in a little, like I said, that's my little bubble.
If you got it, hold on to it.
Right. I have noticed, if I hear it too from other people, that the shift between the times of, like what you're saying, that shame of feeling like, well, how dare I quit this job? Because I got to suck it up and finish it, because that's just what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've been there, you know, it's like, I don't like the crew. I don't like the people, but it's a job. So I got to keep sucking it up and getting through it and just trying to find the best way to manage it throughout each day. Maybe find little wins here and there.
Yeah.
But that's no way to live either. So I have noticed that at least in my experience, the work culture has gotten better.
Yes.
I hope that's the same way for folks listening and other people working around, but it also depends on your boss, right? Who's your director? Because I have noticed it. It's like, who's your director? Because if your director is really tough, then they're going to be tough on their producers.
And the
producers are going to be tough on your post-producer and post-supervisor and down to you.
Yeah.
And down to the editors and everybody. But if your director's chill, cool, and not to say that they're so chill they can't make a film, but in the terms of their personality and how their work ethic and how they run the ship, that does trickle down. And I think that is, it's not so much maybe that the culture's changed, but it still depends on who you're working with.
Yeah.
And I hope that more people are working with cool people. And there is the big difference of like, I'm doing this in industry because I value quality of filmmaking and the shows I work on,
mm-hmm.
and the people that I work with must be of a level that I am admiring, mm-hmm. you know? And so I don't mind getting told I don't mind working 7 days a week or 21 days straight because I'm working on this elite project with this elite director or whoever.
Yeah.
Then there's the other side, which is like, it's a job. I love what I do, and it's a job to put food on my plate and feed my family and take care of my life. You know what I mean?
And, you know, I think there is something to be said. It can be more than a job. It can be a deep love, you know, because some people get really offended when people say it's just a job. If you want a job, go be a banker, you know. And I mean, I think it's important to note that it really is just a job, but you love it and you don't want to do a bad job. You love movies, and what an honor it is to be a part of the process. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think it's lost on many of us that we are just, look, if I wanted to make money, I'd be selling real estate, you know, but we're working on movies. That's cool.
Yeah.
And it's important to, you know, keep stock of that, but also, these movies are making people a lot of money, and they are there to make money. And so, as such, you should be compensated appropriately. And also, you should be allowed to have a life. And there is something, you know, I get a little sad when I see the jokes, you know, the jokes about, oh, 12 hours. I remember my first half day.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you know, chuckle, chuckle, you know, but it's not a... It's not a way to live.
It feels old fashioned a little bit because it's that idea like, you know, your parents saying, well, I had to work, you know, I had to walk uphill both ways to school. And so should you, kind of deal.
Yeah.
Basically pay your dues.
Yeah.
You know, I paid my dues I was young. I did pay my dues.
You do got to pay your dues, but you don't need to be abused.
Well, there's a difference between paying your dues and then knowing as you become more established in your career that you don't put that back on the young folks that was put the things that were put on you.
Don't continue the cycle.
Right. That you make it better for them. Yeah. That's like a life lesson.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, why would you treat your kids the same way that your parents treated you just because that's how you were treated. So they must feel, no, you want it better for them.
Yeah.
So I have noticed that in some cases, you know, that it isn't, maybe as abusive as it used to be, but it, like I said, it all depends on the projects you work on.
It is, yeah. It's the culture always comes from the top down.
I heard, is it a thing that, because this came up a conversation at work the other day about nighttime assistant editors on reality TV. Do you know if that's still a thing?
I honestly don't know.
I got the impression that maybe that was like diminishing. Like that idea of like having to make people work overnights and like, it's really not a good job.
No, I mean, I got my start doing that, but...
So I worked that too, but it sucks. You learn something, but it's like, I don't think I took away the best things from it.
Yeah.
You know, I took away like working on the Avid and learning a little bit more about the Avid, but I didn't take away, like I had a great experience on it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if that's still a thing. But in terms of like the culture and maybe it has to do with like, well, working from home, do you need a nighttime assistant? Because you only have the one Avid. Like maybe now you can get things done remotely. I don't really know.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I got my start, I was digitizing DVC Pro HD tapes. And it's like nowadays, like when I tell people like, I mean, I love VTRs. I think that's so cool. I was playing with D5 HD decks and they're like, what? And it's like, yeah, nowadays everything's file-based. It's like, you know.
We had lunch the other day at work. We were having lunch and our PA shared like his first short film or something, that project he made. And we all watched it and we're like, when did you make this? And he was like, oh, you know. Like it was like 2016, 2017.
Yeah,
thinking, you know, because he's young PA, and we're like, this looks so fucking good.
Yeah,
you know, this is your first like legit thing you made. He's like, yeah, well, I made a lot of this stuff before that. And then I'm like, so then another one of our assistant editors shared their first project.
Yeah,
and looked, you know,
like on DV.
Yeah, and then I showed I showed one of mine that was like 25 years old, which makes me feel old. That it's like I shot a mine on mini DV. It was also, and the one I showed was like also recorded off of VHS. It was the VHS recording of the mini DV output that I made. So it was like doubly like scratched up and everything. But it's just really interesting that, you know, that idea that people, as you grow, you know, you have better equipment and you get better. It becomes easier.
Yeah.
For younger people to get things, make things like that, than it is for us when we were younger. So times change and you kind of have to roll with the times or, you know, get stuck in the past, you know.
But and you know, I think it is worth noting though, because, you know, it's easy to say, oh, you young kids have it so easy. When I was your age, an XL1 cost $3,000 and we didn't have that. True. That is true. But also, because everybody has an iPhone in their pocket and everyone knows that Sean Baker shot Tangerine on the iPhone and you can just go out and shoot a film, and you can and you should, there then becomes this massive glut of films and, you know, of varying qualities and of varying production values. And so it then becomes easier to get lost in all of that because everybody's making their film. So it's cool that there is a democratization of the equipment, and with a little, like, with just a little gumption.
Do you think that has anything to do with the state of the I don't want to say film industry, but Hollywood, in terms of we have so much entertainment. I don't want to say content, but I think of it as entertainment. We have so much entertainment available to us now. And does that have anything to do with ease of access? Even though it's still professional project.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing that, you know, the young filmmaker can have access to on their phone or, you know, anything to make a film, but it's also, I mean, that's more of a streaming topic where streaming has led to young people being able to make films on their phones.
Yeah.
And it's also led to the emergence of streaming, which has allowed Hollywood to find a way to display more entertainment than before.
Well, you know, on the topic of, like, there is more entertainment, I think, you know, I think back to when I was young, and I was really into video games when I was young, long mm-hmm. before I got into movies. But video games was a much more primitive experience than it is now. And I think because of that, I could play Super Mario Brothers or Double Dragon, and that was fun. But if you really wanted to have an adventure, you put on Hook, or you put on Star Wars, or you put, like, the movie was still this grand adventure that you could take. And now, because video games are so good, I mean, Grand Theft Auto 5, you have the entire digitized Los Angeles in your console. I think, you know, the entertainment landscape has become fractured, and there's so many options. And so it's like, I don't think, you know, for example, that film will ever die, but I do think that the time when the film was the thing and that's what you talked about, you know, I was never a sports guy, so I never talked about sports at school, but movies were, you know, I mean, I remember, like, what a big deal Terminator 2 was, and I had really strict parents, so I couldn't watch R-rated movies, and I found a way to watch that one, and oh my God, did you see that? You know,
well, that, you know, you're talking about a time when there was a big difference between the mediums.
Yeah.
Film, television, video games. You know, like, there was a crude difference between all three.
Yeah.
And now it's blurred.
Yeah.
But they're all about equal.
Yeah.
You know, you play a video game today, it looks maybe just as good, if not better, than a movie you watched. And the experience might be more valuable to you because the way they design it, it's that for you to never stop playing.
Yeah.
But that's the weird thing about it, is that it's a... feels to me a manipulated design.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed for you to never stop playing rather than for you to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
And to get to the end.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like the value of, say, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog, I used to play that as a kid. The value was, I got to keep playing to get better at it so I can beat the game.
Yes.
There's an ending. There's an ending to the game.
Well, I think you're also touching upon an evolution in video games, too, in terms of with multiplayer video games, there is that you want to play forever. And then with single player games, there is like a campaign and a story, you know.
And you can argue that streaming in a certain way is a similar.
Yeah.
In terms of we want you to watch forever.
Yeah.
We never want you to stop watching.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what you watch.
Yeah.
Just keep watching.
Yeah.
And that's weird to me because it says it's less about entertaining you as an audience.
Yeah.
It's more about it's about making money. Obviously, I don't know how much money they're making on streaming anymore. Like, you know, sounds like there's not much as what they thought, but
And you touched on something that I think is also really valuable because you said specifically you don't want to use the word content, because I know that's a really divisive term. A lot of filmmakers absolutely loathe the term content, and I understand why. And yet at the same time, a part of me thinks that has always been the eternal battle between the filmmakers and the studios, particularly ever since the studios have become corporatized, and the studios are more corporatized now than they ever have been.
Yeah.
And if we're really honest about it, we can call it whatever we want, whether we call it content and get booed or call it cinema. You know, from the standpoint of somebody who makes something and sells it for most of its history to many studios, it's product. Which is almost a more offensive term, you know.
Sure, you know.
It is what it is.
Would you consider like a Broadway play or Broadway show product?
I mean,
technically it is. Yeah, sure. And I get it. You're selling something. Selling your goods.
And sometimes I feel like we are the infiltrating spies. We are hired to deliver a product, but while we're delivering a product, we're going to inject art. We're going to inject integrity. We're going to make this awesome. And we will obey the notes we're given by our, you know, by our producers, by our studios, by our, you know, you have notes and you have a right to those notes and I will fulfill those, but I'm going to make this great.
Well, because I hear you, but I like to think that the reason why, you know, I'm making a movie,
mm-hmm.
or if I look back to the beginning, I'm not talking about now, maybe like 100 years ago, right? The beginning of film, where I'm doing this to entertain audiences.
Yes.
My goal is to entertain. And you think of it, this comes from live theater.
Yeah.
And there's always been a source of like, we have to entertain the masses. We got to give them, put on a good show.
Yeah.
We want to make people laugh. Want to make people cry. Want to make people feel something.
Yeah.
And film did that in a new medium. And that was still a way to entertain, gather people around in a dark theater to have them have their attention for a few hours.
Yeah.
And I know this kind of goes along with some comments that Quentin Tarantino had made recently while he was at Sundance.
That's right.
Have you heard about that?
Yeah. He was saying, he was talking about the importance of people spend a lot of money to, you know, to take the night out and they want to be entertained.
Yeah. And the idea that, you know, I'm going to put on a good show for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's gotten lost.
Yeah.
The idea of what is entertainment. And that's why I want to call it entertainment, not mm-hmm. content. Because content feels like a passive throwaway object.
Yeah.
It feels like instead of saying content, I'm saying stuff.
Yeah.
It's just stuff.
It's just stuff.
And when you look on streaming on YouTube or on Netflix, it feels like it's just a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But when I go out to see, you know, if I went to see Wicked on Broadway, I was entertained by a show.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, I went and did a thing. But how often do you say, oh, wow, I went and did a thing because I went to the movies?
Yeah.
Not much. But we go to the movies a lot, so that's a little different. But for folks who don't go often, I hope that they would say, wow, I had a great time at the movies.
I know.
But that has become less of an entertaining venue and more of a let's get him in and out quick.
Yeah.
Let's have as many screens as possible with as many movies as possible and things like that. But the idea of getting people's attention to put on a good show and to entertain them and wow them and make something feel like a magical experience.
Yeah.
And I think now as we've gotten so, you know, I remember, you know, I'm old. I remember when I could watch the DVD and get the behind the scenes and I'll find out only then how they made it.
I mean, that was the coolest thing in the world.
Right,
at the
but you know, before then, you didn't know how they made it.
Yeah.
And then the DVD led to, here's a bunch of behind the scenes features, featurettes, where you can watch how they made it. Wow, that's how they did it? Great. Or maybe a television programs. I remember one called what's it called? It was on like Discovery Channel or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Movie Magic, I think it was called.
Okay.
And it was all about behind the scenes of making films. And it was like on television when I was a kid. So you saw it there. But now it seems like hop on YouTube, type in a movie, you get 50,000 different featurettes of behind the scenes of a film you liked.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's now just so readily available that it has diminished the value of that behind the scenes product that would have been on the DVD. And it also limits the boundary between the filmmaker and its audience.
Sure.
There used to be the barrier between the filmmaker and the audience, the film itself and the audience.
Yeah.
And some of that was the, you know, having to only see it at that theater. You know, the only way you could see it is if you got off your butt, drove out to the, you know, planned out dinner, planned out when the movie's playing, got your family out and went to go see it.
Yeah.
And then you couldn't see it again for 6 more months, maybe until it was released on videotape.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another barrier.
Yeah.
I couldn't see it again. And I love this quote from Andy Warhol, which is waiting for something. I'm paraphrasing. I'm totally going to botch this because I forget how it goes. But it goes, there's more value in anticipation. The how it values the object greater because you have to wait for it.
Yeah.
You know, that idea that something is better because I have to wait for it. And I love that quote because, well, the mashup quote, did you find it?
The idea of waiting for something makes it more exciting.
Yes, which, more exciting.
You know what? It's funny you say that because quite honestly, as I'm typing that on my iPhone, I actually felt that sense when I bought my iPhone. I was like, my iPhone's coming in the mail.
Yeah.
And that was more fun than actually using it. I was like, it's a phone.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's the entertainment part. I think we're all in this industry because we like to to entertain. We made our own short films and you gathered people around to watch it.
Yeah.
If I made short films and I just like throw it on a streaming service, I'm like, oh, maybe somebody will watch it. Like, what the hell is the point of this?
Yeah.
And I see movies all the time that are like with big names and they're just thrown right to streaming and no fanfare. I saw a film recently that I could have sworn would have been in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Will Ferrell movie with Reese Witherspoon. You're cordially invited. And no knock to anybody who worked on it. Everyone does a great job making these films as best they can. But it's one of those films where I'm like, this feels like a movie that should be in theaters because it has the star quality.
Yeah.
You know, how if the movie was good or not, that's kind of besides the point.
Yeah.
Because it's not about the there's a lot of bad movies that get in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good movies that get in theaters. There's a lot of good movies that go straight to streaming. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of bad movies that go straight to streaming. But it's less about is it good or bad. It's more like give people an option to go see a dumb comedy in the theater.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
And right now, like I noticed over Thanksgiving or Christmas, I'm like, there's like four different kids movies all released at the same time.
Mm.
It's like Moana 2, or if kid or family.
Yeah.
Moana 2, The Lion King 2,
mm-hmm.
the Wicked maybe was an option, and then like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of kids movies all at once. And maybe that's a normal thing, but it hit me. It just registered to me. I'm like, there's not a lot of options for the adults.
Mm.
You know, maybe the Bob Dylan movie or Wicked or what was it? Gladiator.
Mm.
But that was kind of it. And they're kind of, it felt very skewed.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is maybe a tangent, but
yeah,
it's just that feeling of, yes, I feel it's entertainment because we are trying to entertain and directors try to entertain, whether they want to entertain and wow, make you feel good, or entertain and make you feel sad or tragedy or some kind of like historical thing or some kind of like serious movie that makes you feel something. That's what it's about. That's why I thought Tarantino's quote about or his opinions on it. While some folks may say, oh, he's a little, you know, oh, he's old, he's out of touch.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're young, maybe you feel that way because you're used to having everything on your phone, everything on YouTube, everything on the streaming, and that's just normal.
Yeah.
And for us and someone like Tarantino, who grew up making films in theaters, he helps run movie theaters.
Yeah.
He is a big backer in the theatrical experience. So it's not just like somebody who's just saying it. He actually lives it.
Yeah.
In terms of he runs the New Beverly, but that's his theater.
Yeah.
And this idea that there's something to be said about wanting to hold on to that communal theatrical experience. And who knows how long this streaming thing will it last forever? Who knows? Will it all be merged into one app? I think that would be better.
Yeah.
Because right now it's like, I don't know about you. Are you watching a lot of stuff right now? Or are you?
I'm trying to think of. I mean, I think Skeleton Crew is actually the last streaming show I watched. I'm really looking forward to the conclusion of Cobra Kai. You know, I it's funny because you and I talked about that. Quentin Tarantino quote, and actually as I gave it time, I kind of came to a place with it where I agree with what he's saying. Yes, we do have a responsibility to entertain, and it costs a lot of money to put that butt in the seat and to get a sitter but I would also, I think there are films that entertain, and I think it becomes easy to pick on popcorn films like Marvel films tend to be the ones that everyone likes to pick on, and I think if you want to watch that, then have fun. The bottom line is, did you have fun? You know, and the other people also like to dunk on DC, and my whole thing is, did you have fun?
Yeah.
Then great. That's totally cool.
Yeah.
You know.
But you can't argue that the difference though is that in the past 20 years, the last movie that was in the top 10 most box office earnings of the year, that also was up for awards in the Oscar the Academy Awards season, was 2000, 2001, 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Gladiator, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King,
mm-hmm.
and Chicago.
Yeah.
I think were the last time you had like three, you had movies that were, had the biggest box office, were in the top 10 box office of the year,
yeah,
and won awards.
Okay.
And so I think that's the big thing that people are feeling, that disconnect in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Of like, these movies are big. Like, these Marvel movies are big. They make a lot of money. People like to go see them.
Yeah.
But then there's the critics and the Academy and the voters who are the industry.
Yeah.
It's really strange to me.
I mean,
I'm not saying that, oh, Marvel needs to be, I'm not saying that there's a judgment on that they should or should not be seen as acclaimed films. That's not the point. The point is, it's why is it that the only films that are being looked at right in the past, you know, look at the movies that are all being nominated right now.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, they're good, but like, why is it that they only just came out in the past 2 months?
You know, it's interesting because I do think there's a time and place. Like, you know, it's funny you bring up Gladiator, because Gladiator is one of those films that for me illuminates the power of film, in that Gladiator, this is probably going to sound weird leading into it, but Gladiator as a film, as much as I loved it, I loved the Hans Zimmer score and I loved just the film and the cinematography, and what it meant to me when it came out was one thing, and what it meant to me after my father died was something completely different because of the power of that film. And I was rewatching it the other day, and the scene when he defeats Joaquin Phoenix in the Colosseum. Spoiler alerts here. If you haven't seen
Gladiator, 25 years late.
If you haven't seen Gladiator, yeah, you have to see it. And he's defeated the Emperor, and he's dying himself. And Connie Nielsen, who has felt a sense of affection to him, watches him die, and she knows that he wants to be reunited with his wife and son. And she says to him, "Go to them." And his friend, his friend compatriot Gladiator, buries these little totems to him.
Yeah.
And he says, "I will see you again, but not yet." And that as a moment, like, it was so powerful. And when my father died, it was a moment that helped me cope with his death. And it was like one of those, that is the power of film in a capsule. And I will admit too, similarly, at the end of Avengers Endgame, when Tony Stark is dying and Pepper Potts comes down and the whole idea of, do you hold on and live? And she just says to him, "We'll be okay."
Yeah.
And he dies. And I think maybe because I was younger when I saw Gladiator, I've held on to that more. But I also think the power of that moment also in Avengers Endgame was like, that was such a powerful moment.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's... movies can have that impact on us for sure. And it's interesting that a film like Endgame, that was a lot of popcorn, but had a lot of heart to it and a lot of impact of the legacy of a 10-year like epic, didn't get the acclaim that maybe it could have.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. Things are what they are, but, you know, I just don't really know. It's a bigger question that we could probably dissect right now.
Sure.
But that idea of just why is it that the movies that are most popular and make the most money aren't the movies that are the ones that the voters are enjoying watching the most?
Yeah.
Or why is it that a movie like... okay, so did you see Complete Unknown yet?
No, I really wanted to. I love Bob Dylan and I love James Mangold.
I recommend this one very much, and I thought it was wonderful because of it was a movie that, no spoilers here, but just the general idea that it reminded me of Hollywood from yesteryear.
Okay.
I mean,
are we talking like James Ishtar?
No, not that yesteryear.
Okay.
maybe 20 years ago yesteryear. Okay. But the idea that, obviously James Mangold directed. He's done Logan, which I had just recently watched,
Logan
which is amazing. And that's a movie, that's an example that should have been up for a Best Picture contender the year it came out. Because that was
That's incredible. Not a movie, that's cinema.
Right.
You know, if we're going to do that.
And so, but he also directed Walk the Line.
Yeah.
Very similar as another biopic of
Johnny
Cash at the same time period.
Yeah.
But the idea that it was a film that it made you feel things while also making you feel good.
Yeah.
And it made you, I don't know, obviously maybe it's a low hanging fruit because Bob Dylan's music is in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that he has a lot to say in his poetic tunes. But something compared to I saw The Brutalist. I know you haven't seen that one yet, and not any spoilers, but like the feeling you get after a movie and what you take from it I think has changed in what is a Oscar film these days. It's like, you know, there's a lot of sour notes. There's a lot of cynicism. There's a lot of like dour, like, you know, Nomadland winning. Like, okay, it's, you know, do I really want to watch that again? No, really. It didn't make me feel good. And the movies that are, you know, quality and Academy level winners aren't really the, you know, I didn't even feel any good. I'm not saying that movies always have to make feel good.
Yeah.
But there's that tone of like, it maybe takes you down a path that's not fun, but it maybe there's a lesson learned, or there's, you know, something more to it than just, I want to make you feel like crap just because life's shit.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, thanks for that 3 hours of, you know, kind of thing. But it's all tweets around and everything, but it's just a curious, what is the future?
Yeah.
I think about that. Like, at what point are, it already feels like the, because Oscars are coming up in a couple weeks. And so it makes you think, is this relevant anymore? Because they're it's so out of touch with what is pop culture. But pop culture's changed.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Pop culture isn't what it used to be because we don't all watch the same thing anymore.
Yeah.
And now television has the same quality as film.
Yeah.
And it's all kind of the same. Like, what's the difference between any of it?
Yeah.
So why is the Academy only award? Like, think of all the shows. Think of all like Severance is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
If Severance was written as a film, it might have been one of the best films of the year.
True.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe it'd been a really, really cool sci-fi film.
It would, like, in a very, like, Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jones kind of way.
Yeah, but that idea that one, you make it one thing, and everyone can go crazy over it.
Yeah.
But you spread it out into a bunch of things, and now it's divided.
Okay.
And now everyone's, your attention is divided.
Yeah.
Because I got to watch 8-10 episodes.
Sure.
Oh, and then season two? Oh, we're not going to make it for 2 more years.
That's true.
So, like, it's not even an annual thing. So television isn't even an annual thing anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway, I can keep going on this topic because there's a lot to talk about with that.
Yeah.
I know this really has nothing to do with visual effects editing, but it's still entertainment, and that's why we're here. And I like the idea of we're coming back to the podcast, kind of trying something new with it.
Yeah.
You may have noticed that our co-host Erica is not with us. She may pop in from time to time, but it's just going to be Richard and I for a little while. And the idea of having more of a free-flowing conversation,
let's talk, I think, film. Is
talking film, talking VFX, talking, you know, we could have, you know, like Barry Gibb and from Saturday Night Live, they did the "We're talking politics, we're talking." You know, that reminds me of that.
Talking film,
talking VFX. Talking film. Yeah, that's just kind of what I think we want to do and see what each other's up to.
We want to hear from you as well, too. What do you want to hear us talk about? What questions do you have? If you're new to the industry, whether you're an assistant editor, whether you're a production assistant, you're working in post-production, you have questions about the process, we want to hear from you. We want to help you. What do you want to hear us talk about?
Yeah, please let us know. Are you working? Are you not working? Are you worried about the future? Are you excited about the future? What's going on? But thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on The Render Bar.
Thanks for listening. If you have a question or a topic that you'd like to hear us discuss on The Render Bar, feel free to reach out to us at our email at renderbarpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.